No one can ever be truly ready for what war brings. The best we can do is meet it with our face forward and our hearts clear. You will do that. I know you will.
They know we're coming. They must. With an open government and a free media, that means the HoloNet will have reported on the vote. And surely the Empire knows about the Oculus spying on them from afar.
Almost surely. Ensign Del Tora reports that their fleet has grown and is consolidating in a defensive arrangement. This will not be a surprise for them or for us. It is the purest form of battle. Both sides ready to fight.
It may be a ruse. They may be luring us in.
If they are, we will be ready.
She feels a single tear threaten to slip free of her one good eye, and hastily blinks it away.
Tell me we're going to win this. Tell me this will be the end of it. The end of the Empire, and the start of a new galaxy.
I'm no prophet, Kirsta. I do not know who will win this day, or who will even survive it to see the outcome. I only know it will be an honor to fight alongside you once again. Whether this is our last battle, or the first of many more to come.
His long fingers give her shoulder a squeeze. Agate struggles not to cry out. She wants to run off this bridge and go home. Get in her bed. Hide under the covers, turn out the lights, and wait for HoloNet to tell her who won, who lost, who lived, who died. When did I become this coward? Why am I quaking like a gun-shy child? May the Force be with you, is all she says. Akbar nods.
And with you, Commodore. I must go. It is almost time.
War is coming. And soon, she prays, it is ending.
Chapter 26. The Imperial shuttle circles the base. From up here, Sloane can see everything. The command HQ, the landing platforms, the lines of walkers and starfighters. Everything looks prefab, as if it was hastily constructed. As if it's all temporary, she thinks. The shuttle lands around the far side of the base, easing into a hangar bay whose mouth is eclipsed by the shadow of a tall ridge. Rax is not on this shuttle with her. Brenton is. He sits silently across from her. He's frightened. She can see it in his eyes. The eyes of prey looking up into the jaws of a predator. Sloane will not be scared. She refuses.
I am the predator, she thinks. I'm close now. So close.
Rax may have taken her captive, but that also puts her hands very close to his neck. The ramp opens. Sloane sees that the other two ships sit to their right. One of the troopers shoves her and Brenton down the ramp. Wexley loses his footing, falling hard without his balance, and the trooper ushering him forward stops to kick Brenton in the side. Hard. The others laugh.
This is not my empire, she thinks.
It is sloppy and cruel. They pick Brenton up and push him down next to her. Behind her back, the magnacuffs are uncomfortably tight. Rax awaits her, already off the shuttle. Troopers have lined up on either side of him. And Brendel Hux is here too, the man behind Arcanis. Hux was helping to train the next generation of stormtroopers. She, with the aid of the bounty hunter Mercurial Swift, helped to extract Brendel and his son from Arcanis before it fell to the Republic. He's now on Rax's own Shadow Council. The man's a blustering slob, and she sees that he's let himself go. A gut strains at his belt. His hair is a mess. His eyes look tired. Those eyes look to the margins of the hangar, from left to right. And it's then that Sloane sees that others have joined them, too. Along each wall of the hangar are children. two dozen of them, roughly. They are young, some early in their teenage years, others not yet that age. They all wear plain white uniforms, like night clothes. Rax smiles.
Troopers?
Weapons down, please. We're all friends.
The stormtroopers lower their blasters. But Rax says,
no, no, all the way down. To the floor.
The troopers give one another brief looks of confusion, but do as asked. They stoop, laying the weapons upon the ground. Rax walks up to her, looking her over.
Do you see how the troopers have marked their armor?
Painted it, carved it up,
burned it with hot metal. They have transcended mere service. They are not just soldiers.
They are something altogether more tribal.
More ferocious. Less human. All animal.
He sighs.
But I still don't know that it's enough.
What have you done with my empire? She asks, desperate.
He grins.
Ah, let me show you.
Gallius Rax's hand rises in the air, forming a fist. He snaps his fingers once. The lights in the hangar go out. Sloane's heart jumps into her throat. Her eyes are slow to adjust, but her ears hear the sounds of the fracas. She thinks to run, to duck, to flinch, to flee, but she can't imagine where she would even go or what she would do. All she does instead is tighten her body and lower herself to the smallest profile she can, hunkering down so that her chin is tucked between her knees. Blaster fire lances the dark now, but that doesn't last long. After which there are thumps, thuds, crunches, and grunts of pain. Silence now stretches out for one beat, two, three, until it is ended by another snap of the fingers. The lights come on. Again, her eyes have to adjust. Everything goes from bleeding black to overwhelming white. And as her vision reconstitutes, she sees the floor is littered with bodies. The bodies belong to stormtroopers. All dead by the look of it. Standing over them are the children. Many hold sharp, crude knives with handles swaddled in dark tape. The blades made of black, dull steel. Some knives are buried in the backs of trooper necks, shoved elegantly, perfectly up under the helmet into the brainstem. Some are under the trooper's arms, where another gap in the armor waits and makes them vulnerable. A few of the children hold blasters, too. Rifles venting smoke. One of those children is a tall girl, with her hair shorn to the scalp. Her face is a dead, emotionless mask. Brendel Hux, in contrast, is smiling. It is the smile of a child, giddy, broad, as if he's just seeing outer space for the first time, or just had his first taste of sweet taff. Has she ever seen him smile before? It is a terror to behold. What was it Rax said to her back on the Ravager? Back when he commanded her to rescue Brendel from Arcanus? The Empire must be fertile and young. Children are crucial to our success. Many of our officers are old. We need that kind of vitality. That brand of energy you get with the young. The Empire needs children. Sloane fails to repress a shudder. She dearly wants to vomit, but she dare not give Gallius Rax the satisfaction. The counselor, for his part, offers slow, measured applause.
Behold, Sloane, he says, the future of my empire. I hope you enjoyed the show. You'll soon see that this is only just the beginning.
She has no words. Brenton is speechless as well, having fallen back on his tailbone, slumping against the still body of the trooper that was guarding him. His mouth is open and slack. He His eyes are wrenched wide with horror. And that's when Brendel, finally composing himself, steps forward and whispers something in Rax's ear. Now it is the counselor's turn to smirk.
The final battle is coming, he says. I'd like you to see it. The both of you. You are witnesses from both the old Empire and the conquering rebels. I have a seat for you reserved. Brendel, you and the children escort these two to their seats, will you? Seems I have a speech to give.
Finally, it has come to pass. Finally, the New Republic has smelled the blood he's been casting into the water, and finally, they are arriving to take a bite. It's all coming together. Hux's child soldiers have proven themselves. Yes, those troopers were unarmed, but the sheer speed with which the children dispatched trained soldiers was thrilling to behold. They did it eagerly, but without joy and without fear. Further, he has Sloane in hand. The observatory is protected. And he can finally show her now what he has been doing, and how her failure to have faith in him has cost her a role in the grand finale to come. It is time now to give his speech. He thinks to not give a speech at all. Time is of the essence. The New Republic fleet will be here in a matter of hours, maybe minutes. He and the others have to make their way back to the observatory. But no. The speech will be essential. He must fill the Empire with fire. It is his job to stir them, to enrage them, to prime the detonator before he throws it. Besides, this will be his final mark. It will be captured and saved. It will be broadcast for generations. This is a moment for history. I am making history. Rax has to remember that. His footprint will be indelible, forever pressed into the mantle of the galaxy's memory. He meets with Tashu and Brendel. Both of them seem overly pleased with themselves. Rax sees no reason right now to remind them that they owe it all to him. Let them bloat on the gas of their own satisfaction. Together they move outside the base to meet with the rest of his council, before his empire gathers to hear him speak this last time. Hodnar Borum walks up, hands behind his back, chin up. He suddenly looks 10 years younger, as if the prospect of war is the food that feeds him, the same way water wakes a wilting flower. Borum says as they walk,
"We will win the crown battle handily, Counselor."
Rand is in hologram form, for he is currently aboard the Star Destroyer Inflictor. Beamed by a projector held in the hand of Yup Tashu, the Grand Moff says as his projection bounces,
"Their fleet will be larger than ours, but we have the Ravager. Theirs is still a ragtag force, strategically ill-fed and cobbled together of incompatible ships and squadrons. We are unified, and in that unification, we will win this battle."
"Excellent," Rax says as he strides boldly toward the stage. And he means it. It is excellent. All of it. Even the part where they are wrong. The general asks,
"Where is Obdur? We should be considering our messaging during all of this."
"Ferrick has taken sick,"
Rax answers curtly. It's not a lie. Not really. Being stabbed to death in your bed is quite sickening. That moment serves as another success of Hux's program. A few of the children have proven particularly effective, it seems. His advisors want to keep on nattering at him, but what they have to say matters little, after all, and only serves themselves. It is time to speak. Rax shushes the others with a hand, and strides past them, up a set of metal steps onto the dais. The stage is small, erected at the fore of the base and looking out over the tens of thousands of troopers gathered. Above, the fleet hangs like specters. Around him and the troops are TIE fighters, bombers, troop carriers, shuttles, transports, walkers. The engine of war has thrummed to life. The Empire awaits his talk, though truly right now, he has one audience of note. Behind him and above him, on the roof on the command headquarters, he knows that Sloane and her rebel scum cohort sit. Rax steps out in front of the podium and speaks. His image is projected large behind him, a massive flickering hollow statue. His voice is beamed loudly over all of them, so it is less like a man speaking and more like a god, whose divine command comes as a crashing, crushing wave. The speech that he gives is one he has been rehearsing for months. It is designed as a mechanism. The best speeches are performances meant not to give information or to convey truth, but rather to leave an effect. It is vital not to make his people think, but only to force them to feel. He does not want to leave them with uncertainty. They need only answers. The best speech is not a question mark. It is an exclamation. His voice booms as he speaks.
Loyal soldiers of the Galactic Empire, madness is at our door. Ruffians and barbarians of the Rebel Alliance have claimed for themselves a government of no legitimacy. A government given over to corrosion, chaos, and the corruption born of alien minds and radical terroristic teachings. It was our own Emperor Palpatine who showed us the weakness that presents itself when a republic becomes sick with the disease of craven politics and the illness of elite oligarchs who force their agendas upon us. With the death of our beloved Emperor, our own empire was cast into disorder. It gave strength to the illegitimate and emboldened them with a fraudulent claim of bringing peace and justice to the galaxy. And yet for so long, who have been the champions of peace? The only war visited upon the galaxy has been the one brought by the criminal Rebel Alliance. Scattered and lost, we could have perished. After attacking Chandrilla and injuring the fraudulent politicians who seek to steal the sanctity of our galaxy, I brought us here to Jakku, unifying our people and our powers in this faraway world. A hard world that has tested our metal and forged us and sharpened us into a stronger blade. A blade with which we will slit the throats of the traitors that crawl on their bellies toward our door. Soon they come. Soon they try to finish what they started. They want to end the Empire. They want to set up as a tumor on a healthy body, leeching the blood while growing fatter like a parasite. They deny our legitimacy. They lie about the stability and sanity we created for the galaxy. For those are their truest weapons, deception and delusion. We must not give in. We must not believe that they are right. We must see them as they are. Brutes and barbarians. They are subhuman. They are alien to us in the truest sense of the word, and are deserving of no mercy from us. This is our zero hour. And I call you now to do your duty by the light of the glorious Galactic Empire. The battle to come is not a fight for Jakku, or even a fight for the Empire. It is a fight for all the galaxy. If we fail here, we fail everywhere. We fail our loved ones. We fail our children. We fail all who crave constancy and light in these dark times. We pursue no other aim than freedom from oppression, liberty from lies, Emancipation from depravity! Today is the day we fight back and reclaim our galaxy! Today is the day the New Republic dies at the Empire's hand! Today, we take our future!
If only they knew what that future meant. And then, it's as if the galaxy is listening. As if the Force is truly on his side. For what occurs is an event of such theatrical synchronicity that Gallius Rax nearly drops to his knees and weeps like a baby. The attack begins. Thunder ripples as the New Republic fleet spears the sky, already launching a fusillade, and the Imperial fleet above fires its own in response. Far above their heads, turbolasers slash the sky. Torpedoes corkscrew. Javelins of heavy plasma fire slices open the blue. Rax bellows one last entreaty.
The battle is upon us! Go! Go and drag them down to the ground and break their necks with your boots! Take their heads! End their tyranny!
And now, he must go collect the others and board a ship before it's too late. The observatory beckons, and it is time for his egress.
No, no, no!
Sloane is on her knees. Her hands are bound, so are her ankles. Brenton has fallen over, letting himself topple to the side and curl in on himself. The two of them are up on the roof of the Empire's command building, underneath the flap of a tent. They are alone. No one watches them. At first, Sloane thought, how strange. But now she sees she has nowhere to go, even if she could get free. As she and Brenton are forced to sit there and stomach Rax's speech, she tries to understand what's even happening here. Why let her witness this? What is she even meant to see? The man's speech is base and dull, and full of the pompous rhetorical milk on which Gallius Rax is fed. And yet, it works, doesn't it? Sloane feels it in her own belly. The trumpeting, triumphant roar of an empire spurned. The fear of a New Republic ascendant. The certainty of being in the right and committing violence against those in the wrong. And with that, a tiny mote of doubt plants inside her belly. The seed grows fast tendrils, and she wonders, am I the product of confidently championed lies? Was this my empire all along? Will it die here on Jakku? As Rax's rhetoric finishes, the sky opens up, and as if perfectly timed to the conclusion of his speech, the battle begins. Capital ships rage in the planet's orbit. Weapons fire drums like thunder. Specks appear in the sky and turn from translucent ghosts to buzzing black flies. Starfighters spilling out of the New Republic ships. Already they enter atmosphere, scoring the ground with plasma. And the Empire roars to meet it. TIE fighters lift off, and in moments are launching forth like rocks from a slingshot. Soon the sky is chaos. Fighters erupt in flame. Laser fire rends the air. X-wings and TIE fighters dance in and around banded clouds, while Imperial walkers turn to march out into the desert, ready to protect the base at any cost. The battle in the skies has begun, and soon the ground war will rise. The numbers of the New Republic fleet are superior. She can see that from here. Perhaps Rax stoked the proper ferocity in his troopers, and maybe, just maybe, his people can coordinate a proper pushback. Odinar Borum is one of the smartest ground war strategists, and the troops trust him. But if she's correct, Rand is the man in charge of the skies. And though the Grand Moff is a capable leader, he does not have the courage or the inventiveness to win a fight of this magnitude. Sloane wishes suddenly to be up there. That is her place, commanding those ships,
ruling the heavens, destroying any who dare defile them. The Ravager casts a massive shadow, and she knows that whoever is in command of that ship is wrong for the job. It should be her. She could save the Empire with the Ravager, if she had a chance to get to it. Such ego, she thinks. Perhaps the firepower of that SSD will afford them the chance to save the day. The Empire may win this battle. But even if it does, at what cost? And what else does Rax have up his sleeve? What is the show? Who is the audience?
Chapter 27. The stone trembles. Dust streams from the cavern ceiling, and scree streams from the smooth boreholes that populate Nima's temple. Nora looks to Jazz, worried.
Do I want to know?
It's Bones that answers. The droid tilts his skullish head toward the ceiling, and he hums.
I am intimately familiar with the sound of violence. And that is the sound of violence.
War, Jazz says. Now we're really in the thick of it.
Could it be that the New Republic has finally brought its fleet here? Nora isn't sure what to think about that. She wondered if it was going to be like Kashyyyk, an Empire-controlled planet left to suffer due to the hesitant whims of a nervous voting body.
It'll complicate things, she says.
Jazz shrugs.
At this point, I'm not sure it can get any more complicated, Nora.
With that said, the two of them finish putting on their Imperial officer uniforms.
Nora in non-com black, Jazz in the standard gray. Nora's outfit indicates her role as a prison administrator, whereas the bounty hunter's bars serve to show her ranking as an army staff sergeant.
Do I get a uniform?
I don't think they have anything in your size,
Nora answers.
Maybe if we collapse you down, you can be a mouse droid.
Nora laughs. It feels good to laugh, even if it's short-lived.
Even that small moment of mirth makes her feel better.
Like they can do anything. A little part of her thinks that they can pull this off. Yes, it's dangerous, and completely foolish. Probably a suicide mission. And yet, what choice do they have? She still wants Sloane. But Brenton is now the priority. It's no longer a mission of vengeance, but rather one of rescue.
Nima, to their great surprise, has chosen to help them. Though, really, her aid is not driven by kindness, but rather revenge. Turns out the Hutt Overlord cares little for being perforated by blaster fire. She's furnished them with an old-make Imperial shuttle, a couple of dusty moth-nibbled uniforms, and hopefully solid, high-ranking codes.
Are we ready?
Jazz asks.
I don't know that there is such a thing as ready.
Hey,
Jazz says, offering a steadying hand. The worry on Nora's face must be broadcasting loud and clear.
We're doing the right thing. We're paying our debts. We're finishing the job. There's no greater honor.
Jazz, I know you've given up a lot to be here. This isn't what you do, and you put your life on hold to do it. I don't think I've ever said thank you. You've taken up a cause that isn't yours, and...
Stop. It is my cause, because I've made it my cause. My aunt was a bounty hunter, and she used to help people. She'd abandon jobs to save some group of farmers or help free a bunch of Wookiees. And when I was young, I heard all those stories and I thought she was naive. I said I'd never be like her. But here I am. And you know what I realized? She had it right. The job isn't anything. The job is just a job. And those debts don't mean as much as these debts. The ones between you and me. The ones between...
She seems almost flustered now, like she's exposing too much of herself and can't find the words.
The ones between regular people and the whole damn galaxy. Crewing with you has changed me, Nora Vexley. And I owe you for that.
She offers a hand. Nora takes it. They pull each other into an embrace. Nora says over the bounty hunter's shoulder,
"This sounds suspiciously like one of those talks you give before you die."
"I don't know that we're going to die. But we're about to head into the dragon's den. And we're doing it on a world now smashed between two warring forces. I think it's best to assume we may not make it."
Good pep talk.
"Could be worse. I could be Sinjir."
Gods, I miss him. And I miss my son.
I miss them too. So let's stop chatting and do the work.
Together they leave this small grotto and head back toward where the shuttle awaits. As they get closer, Jazz spins around suddenly, clamping a hand over Nora's mouth and hissing for her to shush.
"What the..."
Imari touches a finger to Nora's ear,
a sign to listen.
So she listens.
Voices.
They float through the passageways, and instantly she recognizes one of them. Mercurial Swift. Jazz waves them forward, whispering for Bones to be quiet. The droid's legs bend inward, and he eases forth on the tips of his skeletal toes. Together they gather around the bend, just before the passageway empties out into the smooth, sculpted cavern mouth where the shuttle is parked. And it's there they see Swift. He's not alone. With him are three others. A broad-shouldered Cayuso, a round-bellied human with a filthy head swaddling, and a tall Rodian with antennae so long they almost droop over her bulbous blue-black eyes. They stand before Nima. The shuttle waits just beyond them, which means the path is blocked. Mercurial is saying to Nima,
"I know she's here, Hutt. We saw our ship land. Point us to the Zebrek, and we go in peace."
"And if not?"
the Hutt asks. It's the man in the head swaddle who answers. He points a long-barreled rifle and growls,
"Then you go in pieces."
"It is unwise to threaten a Hutt."
"That's Dengar,"
Jazz whispers in a hushed voice. Mercurial leans in, his chin up and out.
"And it's unwise to disappoint me. I'm on Black Sun's payroll, slug. I matter. You're just some backwater worm with no power in the galaxy. It looks like somebody already shot you up good. And I'm happy to finish the..."
Nima's hand darts out, catching him by the throat. She lifts him up high. His legs dangle as his cheeks bloom red, then purple. Is the sound he makes.
"You insignificant speck of insect waste."
Dengar thrusts his rifle up into Nima's face. The barrel presses hard against her nose slits.
"Careful, love. I don't much like Swift either, but I'm gonna have to ask you to set him gently down. I'd hate to spray your head slime all over the pretty rock."
Nora's heart sinks. She hoped that Nima would be able to handle this, but the Hutt does as commanded. She drops Mercurial.
"I have a plan," Jazz whispers.
"I'm all ears."
"I'll distract them. You and Bones take the ship and go."
"What? You must have given yourself a concussion when you broke those spikes off your head, Jazz. I'm not leaving you behind."
Jazz eases Nora back and gets in close, nose to nose.
"Listen, Nora. Those bounty hunters are skilled. If we leave them alive, they'll alert the Empire that we're coming, and our cover will be blown."
"Bones can handle them."
The Rattletrap B1 nods furiously at that.
"You'll need him," Jazz says. "We can't risk it. They want me, so they'll get me. I'll catch up later."
"Jazz, wait!"
But it's too late. She goes back the way she came.
"Damn it, Imari!"
Next thing she knows, it's happening. Jazz yells from somewhere deeper in the passageways. And with that, the bounty hunters turn toward the noise. And true to the plan, They bolt in her direction. The sound of blaster fire fills the temple, echoing through the chambers. Nora wants to wait and help. She wants to use bones and take out the hunters. But Jazz is right. She can't risk it. Brenton. Sloan. The Imperial base. That's the goal. The stakes are huge, and she can't risk them on this. Gritting her teeth, Nora tells Bones to hurry, and together they run for the shuttle. Chapter 28. At a distance, the tactics of combat are about the battle space, or the arena one is given in which to fight. The battle space above Jakku is nearly limitless. Its moons orbit far enough away not to enter the fray. There exists no debris field as yet, and the only object forming a boundary to the assault is the planet itself. That gives the New Republic the advantage of coming at the arena from all angles except below. But the advantage of the Empire is that the fleet is neatly compressed. It has created a nearly perfect defensive perimeter formed of its own destroyers, with the Ravager at the heart of it. That dreadnought has the chance to fire its considerable armament from relative safety, but its angle of attack is limited by the ships that form a sphere of perimeter. It cannot fire wantonly and without regard for its own ships. That is war. It is the placement of ships. It is the advantages and disadvantages of those placements. It's about how you move, how you fire, what weapons you bring. Every piece fits into the larger whole. Ammunition in a blaster, blaster in a pilot's hand, pilot inside a starfighter or frigate. Everything is a resource. How do you expend them? In what direction? At a distance, war is a game. However deadly. Usher this ship there, that ship here. Converge, fire, dominate, defend. But when you're in it, there exists no distance at all. When you're in it, the decisions you make feel less tactical and more elemental. For you are part of two forces crashing together like waves. Like two mountains toppling into each other. Like two planets colliding and breaking apart. There exists no distance, no separation. Not for Commodore Kirsta Agate, at least, who cannot separate herself out from the orchestrated chaos beyond the viewport of her Starhawk. No, she and her crew and her ship are part of the fabric of the battle space. She is not a divine hand engineering the movement of pieces on a game board. Rather, she is one of the pieces. The bridge is swarming with tension. Comm officers keep her in touch with Akbar and the other Starhawks. Weapons officers, led by Ensign Sarai, a Pantoran, coordinate all systems to ensure the most effective targeting. A trio of white-helmeted navigators sit nearby, guiding the ship's movement through the battle space, cutting through the chaos like an axe. And Agate stands in the center of it all. She gets commands from Akbar. She relays her commands to the bridge via the senior officer, Lieutenant Commander Spawn. All the while, she feels like she is the star around which everything else orbits. She's not, of course, but she suspects every officer commanding a capital ship feels this way. Out there, in the broad viewports that rise above her like the arches of a cathedral, TIE fighters slash past, chased by or chasing New Republic ships. Corvettes lead the charge, pushing on toward the destroyers, launching their full armament ahead of them, torpedoes that leave indigo streaks in the black. The other two Starhawks slide in on each side of the Concorde. To starboard side is the Unity. To port is the Amity. Agate feels it all, as if her skin, her veins, her nerves are all connected to the battle by puppet strings. Her flesh prickles. The hairs on her neck stand tall. It's the strangest feeling, and it never fails to find her. The suspicion that if she blinks or twitches a finger in the wrong way or dares to cough or sneeze, somehow that movement will ripple out across the battle. Her ship will crash. Her friends will fall. The enemy will conquer them all. Absurd, but that is how Algate feels about war. No distance to be found at all. It is intimate. It is anxious. She is part of it, and it is part of her. The same way a heart is not separate from the body in which it beats. One of the corvettes goes up in a bright ball of coruscating energy. An X-wing spirals, sparking through space. One of the Nebulon frigates breaks in half, its front end still firing the full detachment of weapons, peppering the side of a Star Destroyer. Algate feels it all. Every death feels like her own. But that is the trick, isn't it? She can't let it overwhelm her. That will come when it's all over, should she survive. At night, it'll feel again like she's dropped over the edge of an abyss. Like she'll want to die. She'll bite a belt or the side of her bed to stop all the thoughts and the endless loop of violence replaying in her head over and over. All she allows now is that slight shaking that always comes. The one she cannot deny. The one that has become part of who she is. Everything else, all the other tremors, will wait until nighttime. Again, if she survives. For now, she and the other two Starhawks have one job. Bring down that dreadnought. Destroy the Ravager. End the fight. Let's get to it, then. Temin is lost. He told himself he'd be fine. He thought,
I've piloted ships before.
And weeks before, he was right here, in the same space above Jakku. He survived that, and he told himself he could survive this. But now, he's not so sure. Wedge said the plan was simple. They weren't meant to be here at the battle, so their role was to provide support. Stay out of the way of the big ships and pick off the TIEs swarming around. Phantom Squadron leapt out of lightspeed late to the battle, and like a massive beast, it swallowed him whole. TIEs roar past. He's separated from the others. Ahead, Star Destroyers loom in space that turns with a kaleidoscopic twist. A Corellian corvette plunges through open space in front of him, its back end breaking apart in plumes of fire that go from red to green to gold as different gases and fuels vent into the black. Temin screams, pulling back on the flight stick and trying to right the old X-wing he pilots. He doesn't know which way is up, down, left, right. Use the screens! Use the console! He looks, finds the stabilizer display, then looks up again, and alarms go off!
I'm about to crash into the side of a New Republic frigate!
The side of that ship looms large, coming up fast like a wall crashing down. Another scream as Temin turns the X-Wing starboard, spiraling through the battle zone so fast he feels like he's about to puke in his helmet. The ship rocks with laser fire coming from behind. His astromech, a hexagonal dome droid with designation R3W5, whistles, and his screen fills with warnings. His scopes show he's not alone. A pair of TIEs are on him, like a set of black flies on a Nerf's haunches. Except he doesn't have a tail with which to swish them away. And he just can't shake them. They sense the stink of sickness on him. He's like the weak one in the pack. The one a predator knows instinctively to hunt.
Blast it all to hell! Come on, Temin! Get your head out of your hind end and stay alive!
One of the TIE fighters explodes, turning into a fiery cannonball alongside him. It tumbles away, destroyed. Coco's voice fills his comms with a whoop and holler. The Narquaw cackles and says,
Ah! One down! The whole damn empire to go!
The fuzzy blue pilot whistles and belches into the mic just before his X-Wing whips past. Next, it's Jethper, the Quarren. He says something in Quarrenese. but Temin has no idea what it is. Yara fills in the details.
Jethi's right. Snap, you're like a sparking wire out there.
The Twi'lek comes out alongside him as her Y-Wing blasts through the second of the ties sticking to him like a burr. Wedge's X-Wing pulls out in front.
Everyone form up on me. Snap, you good? You want to set coordinates home? Nobody would blame you.
I'd blame you!
Coco barks, then belches again.
No,
Temin says, even though he wants to say,
Yes, yes, yeah. I totally made a mistake. I need to go home. I didn't think this through.
But then he thinks of his mother. She's here. So is he.
I'm good. I'll stick with you. But I gotta be honest, it's crazy up here.
And it is. Even forming up behind Wedge and having someone to follow, the sheer amount of visual information is about to give him a nosebleed. Streaking lines of plasma, torpedoes corkscrewing in the distance between capital ships, fighters everywhere, and fire and debris. Not to mention that ring of Star Destroyers protecting the Dreadnought from the encroaching New Republic capital ships.
Keith's right,
Yara says.
It's a little too hot here. Could use some room to breathe.
Above them, an A-Wing shears through the vacuum.
Got ideas?
It's Temin who has one.
Maybe we head down below. We can punch a hole in their air-to-space defenses, get some clearance for our ground forces.
It's a dumb idea. He knows it is. And a selfish one. He just wants to get the hell out of here. And he wants to be as close to Jakku as possible. That's where his mother, his droid, and his friend Jazz are. So it surprises him when Wedge agrees.
Snap, that's a fine idea. All right, Phantom Squadron, let's get a closer look at Jakku. Take out as many of the bad guys as you can on the way.
Coco whoops. Temin takes a deep breath and pushes down on the flight stick, following Wedge and the others through the chaos.
I'm coming, Mom.
Black pillars of smoke rise above the horizon as Nora pulls the Imperial shuttle over the last canyon ridge and back down over the dunes. Above, she sees the two fleets in orbit. The skies flash and pulse with the lightning of ship-to-ship artillery. Down here, fighters already swarm. The New Republic is establishing landing zones 100 clicks east toward Crater Town. She sees the U-Wings swooping in like fat birds, disgorging commandos. Already she's starting to see the sands littered with debris, skeletal husks and bent beams smoldering in the hellish Jakku sun. Her eyes follow movement, and she sees a larger ship, a corvette by the looks of it, streaking downward toward the surface of faraway mountains. The way it moves, it's like slow motion. Fire and smoke trailing as bits fall away, catching the light, like a firework falling back to ground. It would be beautiful if she didn't know there were lives at stake. Those inside may already be dead. If not now, then soon, when it hits. A sad reality of every downed ship. Not everyone makes it to an escape pod.
I got a bad feeling about this,
she tells Bones, who sits dutifully next to her. Servos whine as the droid turns his head toward her.
Prepare to fire all cannons,
Bones says, his voice warping so that it has a strange hard-angle accent to it.
Commentary. I say we blast the meatbag and save you the trouble, Master.
Bones, are you all right?
The droid seizes up for a moment, then relaxes once more.
Sorry, Master Temin's mom.
The droid shrugs.
Glitch.
Great. Flying into a war zone with a malfunctioning battle droid. In a stolen Imperial command shuttle, no less.
Ahead, the raging battle is like a storm. It has margins. It contains darkness. And she flies right into the heart of it. Soldiers march below. Blaster fire pocks the underside of the shuttle. Because those are Republic soldiers, and she's in an enemy shuttle. Of course they'll take their shots. She eases back on the stick, lifting her ship higher in the air, away from the ground forces. It's about 500 clicks yet to the base. Her screens flash red. Two ships drop down from below and form up fast on her tail. Two Republic starfighters. The galaxy apparently thinks she enjoys irony, because the two ships it serves up are Y-wings, just like the one she used to pilot. The shuttle shakes as they fire on her. Her options are few, and none of them are good. She could try to signal them, but at best they won't believe her. And at worst, she risks the Empire picking up her transmission and realizing she's stolen their ship. She could try to take them on, but the last thing she wants on her conscience is a pair of downed allies who had to die just so she could keep her cover. The one option she has is just to outfly them, which isn't easy in this bucket-belly shuttle. A shuttle is an easy target, but maybe they don't want an easy target. What if she gives them a better target? There, ahead, just over those mounding dunes, one massive AT-AT walker marching over the surface of Jakku. It's not alone. A pair of two-legged AT-ST chicken walkers strut on either side of it, firing cannons at a wave of advancing Republic soldiers. There. That'll give the Y-Wing something to deal with. The Y-Wing is a better bomber than it is a dogfighter, and that AT-AT will make a tantalizing target. Nora grits her teeth and brings the shuttle in low, aiming right for the stooping cockpit ahead of that big walker. The Y-Wings just need to see that they have a better bullseye, and as she closes in, close, too close, Nora pulls up on the shuttle hard. It shudders as it hits a patch of turbulence. She cuts the engines so the shuttle moves into a stall. Beneath her, the Y-Wings blast past, on toward the walker. Did it! Oh, now to get this ship out of its stall. The engines rev, but don't fire. No, no, no! Come on, you old piece of Imperial scrap! Come on! The shuttle crests atop a pillow of air and starts to fall back toward Jakku. Back toward the walkers, the soldiers, toward the unforgiving sand and stone. The ship spirals. Nora roars in frustration as she struggles with the controls, trying to get the engines to fire. Down here, it feels like he can breathe. Space is dizzying, but the planet's surface as an entity separate from the blue sky gives Temin his bearings. And with his bearings comes his confidence. He snaps his fingers, cracks his knuckles, and grips the flight stick. He brings his fighter in and follows the rest of Phantom Squadron. Wedge calls for them to break formation over the battlefield and take out any TIEs or troop carriers they see. Temin moves the X-Wing down over the rolling hills of sand. And now he's starting to feel it. The ship feels less like a machine in which he sits and more like a part of him, like a limb, like a set of wings, like an extension of his mind. Don't think about it. Just do it. Ahead, a transport catches air over a dune, and he scissors his wings open and opens fire with all four laser cannons. The wings spit burning light, and he doesn't even need to scan his scopes. Every blast hits the transport, and the front end of it craters in, dipping down into the sand and flipping its back end over its front. Coco's mad hoot fills his ears as he pulls up on the stick.
You're like a surgeon with that thing, Snap!
Damn yeah, I am! Not far to port, a TIE Striker pinwheels through the air, smashing into the sand, thanks to Wedge, who crosses his T-65 in front of Temin's. In the distance, Temin can see a walker stomping across the sand, firing at a pair of Y-wings that circle it like starving vultures. Over the comm, Wedge says,
"Let's give the Yellow Aces some love. Help them out with that walker."
Phantom Squadron whips toward the walkers. Temin thinks to engage the AT-STs, but a better target presents itself. An Imperial command shuttle spiraling down toward the ground. He thinks to let it be, because that ship is about to be scrap and vapor. And yet suddenly, The engines glow blue as they refire, and the shuttle pulls out of its tailspin just moments before impact. It catches air, the one wing nearly drawing a line in the sand before righting itself and heading in the other direction. It's a command shuttle. That means officers are on board. Officers are high-value targets. That he knows from his days hunting Imperials with Mom and the others. Officers are their ones with faces on the Pazak cards. When you're fighting a monster, you cut off the head and the hands. And that's what he's going to do here. He radios to Wedge.
See that Imperial shuttle, Phantom Leader? It's fleeing, but I'm gonna go after it.
All right. Good hunting, Snap. Don't range too far.
You bet, Phantom Leader.
Temin grins and guns the starfighter toward his new target. Just as Nora rights the shuttle and points its nose toward the locational reticle of the distant Imperial base, a new blip appears on our scopes, blinking a warning. An X-Wing. Older model. A T-65C-A2. She moves to evade. Lasers bolt past. Just as she thought she was safe, the chase begins anew. Her heart hammers against the inside of her breastbone, and the ship shudders too, as the wing takes a hit, peppered by fire from whoever it is that's pursuing her. Nora brings the shuttle low over the dunes, then high over an arched rock formation that looks like a man on his hands and knees. She whips left, right, but the X-Wing isn't persuaded to pull away. It stays on her like it's got a tractor beam lock, perfectly lined and ready for the kill. More laser fire. One of the shuttle's engines goes out. The ship lists left. The inside of the cabin fills with the stink of ozone and burning electric. What a thing, she thinks, to be taken out at the end by my own side. The cabin flashes. Missile lock! That X-Wing will be loaded for bear with proton torpedoes. That is no surprise. What's a surprise is that whoever is piloting that thing would expend one to take out a command shuttle. It's overkill. The pilot flying that fighter is naive. There are far better targets out here for that ordnance. Bones, to her surprise, suddenly stands up. The little antenna at the top of his skull, which is itself bolstered and fixed to a small and narrow pin bone, begins to blink green.
Where are you going?
She says through gritted teeth, trying to maintain control of the shuttle. Bones does not answer. Instead, he hits a button on the console. The ramp. He's lowering the ramp. He's getting off the ship.
Bones, get back here! Bones!
A thrill rises inside Temin's belly. His blood is up. His nerves are buzzing like vibroblades. He stayed on the shuttle's tail like he's been glued to it. And it's enough to earn him an easy missile lock. Ahead, the shuttle squares out in front of him, and his thumb finds the top of the flight stick. He has no conscience in this moment. He doesn't think about who is in that ship. He knows it'll kill them, but he doesn't think of it that way. Temin feels something altogether more vicious and aloof. He just wants to win. He just wants to score a victory for the Republic. And the Empire here is less a shuttle carrying officers and more a symbol. A symbol he can shoot down right here, right now. His thumb hovers over the button. Then, the shuttle's ramp begins to descend. In midair.
What the...
Maybe whoever's in there is trying to jump out. But why? The front end of that thing is its escape pod. Just attach and go. A droid makes its way down the ramp. It holds on to the pneumatic piston from which the ramp descends.
His droid waves at him. Oh, gods. Is that... Bones?
Over the comm comes the droid's mechanized voice.
I thought that might be you, Master Temin. Please hold.
Please hold? What are you...
Bones! Bones!
Moments later, a crackle. as his mother's voice comes from his wrist comlink.
Temin? Temin?
At first,